Happy, welcome to today's teaching. Welcome to Ndoa Teachings. Karibu sana. The goal is just to dive into the Bible and to see what it has to offer. I was wondering where to start, considering this is the first video. And for sure, there's no better place to start. Okay, well, there may be. But I want to start at Matthew chapter 1. So I'm recording this February 1st, 2021. Meaning it's the very beginning of 2021. 2020 was what it was, to attend in your story. But most of the times when someone begins a year, what they actually do is they set resolutions, nini. One of them, especially for Christians, is usually like reading the Bible all through from beginning to end. Some go chronologically, so vile zimefuatana hivyo kwa page zinaenda, some ziwenda old, new. And so wakianza wanaanza this Genesis, and then there's Matthew. And so what happens is, on the very first page of Matthew, you find a genealogy. And yo, it's boring. Because unaanzanga, and then it's all about Abraham. We got Isaac. We got Jacob. We got Judah and his brothers. And then Judah, we got Perez. And you wonder, where is this going? But that's where I want to start at. Most of the times you'll think there's nothing good there apart from maybe you ko na mtu wako na mko expectant and I'm not after baby names. But I believe that specific passage has a lot going on, and that's what I want to try and pack. There's a lot of juice. We'll do this in 3 different videos. That's how much juice there is in that passage. But yeah, so I'll try just to show why I think that's like even like the best introduction to the New Testament. And so what I ask you to do, if you can, grab your Bible. I'll give you a minute to do that. Grab your Bible. I'll go through a few things faster. If you can be able to just cross-check yourself as well, that would be wonderful. But you know what? Let's dive in. Sideways, ni my fans on and distract also, don't worry. I'm just kidding. So we look at Matthew, the first chapter, the very first bit. There's a genealogy. To be honest, I won't read it. That's Matthew 1:1-16. But I want to read verse 17, and that's where we're going to be at. So this is what it says. All those listed above include 14 generations from Abraham to David, 14 from David to the Babylonian exile, and 14 from the Babylonian exile to the Messiah. And so this is a summary statement of kile amedu. Amesema, kwanza alianza na kusema, alianza na kusema, this is a record of the ancestors of Jesus the Messiah, a descendant of Abraham and of David. Alafu ndo akaendelea akiwataja akisema Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, huyu, akaenda hadi mwisho. Alafu finally akasema, all those I have listed above, kile nimedu hapo juu kama umenotice, they include 14 generations from Abraham to David, and then 14 from David to the Babylonian exile, and then 14 from the Babylonian exile to the Messiah. So this video is about the numbers game. I want to show you how Matthew is playing around with numbers just to make a point, and it's going to be a grand one. So like, just follow through. So that statement, I feel like Matthew is saying, yo, check. No, now, umesoma hiyo list hadi place tuko sahi, but did you see what I was trying to do? Did you see what I did there? And he's telling you plainly, saying 14. So when you think 14, you should think 7 times 2. And most of the times, this is how the Bible writers work. They use numbers. Ideally, in their culture, when someone from their culture is reading a first, 2 millenniums to 3 millenniums ago in ancient Israel, akisikia hiyo word connecting, I mean, especially numbers, different word at times. And so when you think 14, think 7 times 2. And this is common in Christian circles, but what wanajua that the number seven is, I know you said it, perfection, completion. Okay, maybe if you're not a Christian yet, then maybe you wouldn't know. But maybe you've heard about it. That a lot of time when they talk about seven, immediately they want you to think completion, perfection. And you see it all over scripture. So when you see about the creation story, the very first story that's in the Bible, we are told that the world is created in 6 or 7 days, depending on how you want to think about it. Because on the seventh day, it usually says, and God had finished creating. So it's up to you to answer. Finished creating, is it creating or finished creating? I don't know if that's how we should work out nini. Kwa kazi zetu, unasema you have a 4-month project, unaifanya in 3 months, alafu the 4th month, unasema I am finishing the project, but it is finished. Anyway, such a dry joke, but take some water with it. Anyway, so here's what happening. On the first day of creation, the idea is on the 7th day, God rested. The idea is it's a done deal. God has created a perfect world. He rests on the 7th day. There's an interesting story in Joshua chapter 6 where the children of Israel wametoka Egypt, went through, crossed the Red Sea, went through the wilderness, and then finally they are now entering into Canaan. And one of the cities they find is a city called Jericho. And we know this story where they're told they're supposed to go around it. But here, how the narrative tells it. It says, now the gates of Jericho were tightly shut because the people were afraid of the Israelites. No one was allowed to go out or in. But the Lord said to Joshua, I have given you Jericho, its kings, and its strong warriors. You and your fighting men should march around the town once a day for 6 days. Here's a bit. 7 priests will walk ahead of the ark, each carrying a ram's horn. On the 7th day, you are to march around the town 7 times with the priests blowing the horns. When you hear the priests give one long blast of the ram's horns, you have all the people shout as loud as they can, then the walls of the town will collapse and the people can charge straight into the town. And so you see, it's very dramatic. For 6 days, they just go once. Wanazunguka mara moja alafu wanadoze. But on the 7th day, wanaambiwa, 7 priests waongoze, wanabeba ark, you'll go around. And then on the 7th day, you go around 7 times. And the hint is in verse 2, where it says, I have given you Jericho, its kings, and all its strong warriors. Again, it's a done deal. Same way as creation done 6 days, on the 7th day, done deal. Same here. Walk around it 6 days. 7th day, 7 times, 7 priests. Done deal. So I really want to labor this point, Adi Ikufe. So let's just do this. There's a story in 2 Kings chapter 5 as well. It's very interesting. It's about a guy called Naaman, who's a Syrian commander of the army. So, like, he's a big deal. But there's something that's going on with him. And the thing is that he has leprosy. So he has this skin disease that people don't know what to do with you. So most of the times, people don't stay close to you. It was a really tricky disease, to be honest. And so, Ndoyo akona leprosy and he doesn't know what to do. So in his homestead, so normally when they were raiding people, they would bring back people and they would be slaves. So in his homestead, there's an Israelite girl, like a small girl, who when Naaman is trying to find a solution for this disease, the girl says, yo, you're struggling for no reason, go to Israel. There's this prophet, he's called Elisha. He'll sort you out, I'm certain. So Naaman is like, okay, sure, goes to the king. The king of Syria writes a letter to the king of Israel saying, I'm sending Naaman. He needs help from your people. So the king of Israel receives this letter and he panics. He's like, oh my God, watu wanaanza vita. Mbona wametuma umse, mimi siwezi mtibu. So Elisha gets wind of the letter that has been sent and just tells the king, imagine, acha kirere, this was not for you. Just tell them to come to me, I'll sort them out. So Naaman comes to, I hope that's how it's pronounced. Naaman comes to Israel. And then he goes to Elisha's home. But what happens is, Elisha doesn't even come out. He sends his messenger, and this is what the messenger says: go wash yourself 7 times in the Jordan, and your flesh will be restored, and you will be cleansed. And so Naaman is ticked off, because anashanga, nimetoka kukwata nikuje nijitumbukize kwa mto. And then this mto is so dirty, and it's so filthy, and he's saying, I can't do this. I'm a Syrian commander. You know what? Even he didn't come to meet me, imagine he didn't come to meet me. Naaman, I'm not going into that river. Domana naitwa Naaman. Anyway, so akakata your story. Alafu, but one of his advisors or his servants just said, yo, you've come all the way. There's no need to just reject the advice. If he told you anything else, would you not have done it? And so Naaman is like, okay, sawa. And so he goes into the river, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. And then when he comes out, it says, so he went down and dipped himself in the Jordan 7 times, as the man of God had told him, and his flesh was restored and became clean as that of a young boy. And so like, akidu number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, akitoka alikuwa najipata bado ako na madoadoa or whatever. But on day 7, looking like a young boy. Yeah. So that was Naaman's story. And then now there's someone who's called John. And like, John is obsessed with this number 7 to make his point that Jesus is the one whom you, when you believe in, you get eternal life. He uses this 7 all over the place. In the first chapter, when he's introducing Jesus, he's encountering different people: John the Baptist, Andrew, Simon, Philip, Nathaniel, Nini. And there are 7 titles that are ascribed to Jesus. You get to John chapter 2, and we get the first miracle, so to speak, where it said that he turned water into wine, and then he says this is the first sign. And then he's just counting down. In chapter 5, you'll see this is the second sign. You should go on counting for yourself. Finally, you realize that the 7th sign is the resurrection. There are 7 times where he uses the 7, the I am statements. He does it 7 times. So, I am the bread of life. I am the good shepherd. I am the gate. I am the true vine. 7 different times. And then also there's like 7 I am declarations, where he uses I am as a covenant name of God to the Israelites and uses it for himself. So at some point in chapter 8, he says, before Jesus was, I am, to the Samaritan woman. They're having a discussion about religion. The woman says, you know what? When the Messiah comes, he'll tell us. And then he says, you know what? I am. And so there are 7 times when he uses that declarative I am. So there's 7 times I am, 7 times I am statements, 7 signs, 7 titles at the beginning. The final story is a narrative where Jesus is interacting with his disciples for the last time. Guess how many they are? There are 7. And so that's a point. When they're using this number, they're trying to talk about a culmination, a fulfillment, a completion, a perfection that is happening. And when you get to the book of Revelation, you're 7 itakuchok, and it's no joke. You'll see it on every page. It will overwhelm you because of how it's everywhere and it's doing everything all the time. But it's a great fit, considering that's a culmination of the story of the Bible. That's the last book. It would make sense that there are so many 7s that are going on there, you know. And so that's the thing, that this culture they're in, when you say 7, you're saying more than counting. You're giving a number that's telling a story in itself. And I would argue that this happens in most cultures as well. When you think about it, in the culture that we find ourselves in, I was trying to think if there's an equivalent, and I was thinking of the number 3. And when you think about it, there's a saying that says, the third time's a charm. To mean, you can try the first time, it will fail. You can try the second time, it will fail. But when you do it the third time, yeah, it's going to work out. That's not based on statistics. That's not based on science. It's just a way culture decided to use this number, so to speak. There's something that's called the Goldilocks effect. I don't know if you've read that book by Goldilocks, where he's a girl, he's running around, finds a house. The first cup of porridge, too hot. Second cup, too cold. Third cup, just right. He finds a bed, first bed, too hard. Second bed, too soft. That bed, just right. Number three. In American culture, I don't know if it's there in Kenya, and this might be an unfortunate example, but it's an example. But they often say that, they call it the three dates rule. And it's about when you're going on dates with someone, the acceptable time to engage in sexual intercourse with them, and my friend, it sounds serious, is on the third date. So not the first one, not the second, the third. Like when you think about it, where is that coming from? This idea of number three being the optimal time, so to speak. That's there in our culture. When we're giving prizes, we give number one, number two, number three. Like, where did that come from? Ikoni number four I deserve. Mbona number three ako hapo. Mbona to spend number one and number two. The podium is number one, two, three. And so cultures do this. Sometimes number represents more than the counting that they are doing. And for these people, when you hear Matthew saying 14, you should think 7 times 2. And when you think that, just think culmination, completion, the time has come. Okay, let's breathe. Back. So we were able to see what Matthew was trying to communicate with the number 7. That 14 ilikuwa inafaa kukuscreamia, ilikuwa inafaa kujump out of the page akisema, I've listed 14 from here to here, 14 from here to here, 14 to from here to here. It was supposed to jump at you. You are supposed to think 7 completion. So we've already looked at the number aspect, about the number, the specific number. But there's more that Matthew is doing, and I want to show us how also a genealogy can be numbered in such a way that the number of the genealogy also is telling a story. So we just talked about numbers, how they are saying something. So also numbered genealogies say something as well. And I want to give an example that I hope will make sense on what is happening. So two illustrations from the book of Genesis. There are two genealogies that are happening there. There's one that's from Adam to Noah, and there's another one that's like from Shem to Abraham. Abraham, but Sinai to Abraham. So there are those two genealogies. When you look at them, I hope you're looking at them right now, but when you look at them in your Bible and then you count them, what you realize is like Adam to Noah, when you count them, 1, 2, 3, 10. And then we are told a story about Noah, and then it goes to Shem, and then Shem to Abraham, and then you count them, 1, 2, 3, 4, 10. And so when you think about it, when you think it's more, it's like kind of, the genesis of humanity is being told, the origins, the beginnings of humanity is being told. And then we are told a story about Abraham. And then we fast forward, we want to get to some guy called Noah. And Noah is going to be a significant character. And then his story is done. And then we start fast forward so that we can get to Abraham. And so it's very specific, 10, 10. I don't think it's a coincidence. I think it's very intentional what they are doing. They're just saying, after I count 10 people, this 10th person, this guy is going to be significant, man. And so the 10th person in the first one is Noah. And we know the story, you fast forward, a laugh in a pause. And for a few chapters, we are told a story about Noah. And then the story goes on. And then after the story of the Tower of Babel, there's a genealogy. And then there's a guy called Abraham. And we know he has a good chunk of the story as well. And so, and that's the idea. I think when they're using the number 10, they're saying, look out for the 10th guy. This guy is going to be significant in the story that's coming. And so with that in mind, I want you to think about the book of Ruth. I know this book is very familiar to Christian women who are single. Female, single Christian women. Whichever, it's common for them. Class 7 English teacher, forgive me, I don't know, Sokatoa. No, that wasn't Nini, order of adjectives. What was order of adjectives? Sokatoa is about sine and cosine. Anyway, whatever. So, where are we? The book of Ruth. So there's an interesting story that's being told. We're being told about a lady called Naomi, and everything is Naomi for her. Everything is happy. Everything is well. Everything is good about Naomi. Has a husband, loving home, 2 kids. They're actually sons. Naomi is living his her best life, so to speak. And then tragedy comes, and so there's a famine, and they have to move, and they go to another land where they're now foreigners. And then another tragedy happens, the husband dies, and then another tragedy happens, and then the 2 sons die. And so Naomi is left alone in a foreign land. She actually says it herself, that she feels she's very bitter at what has happened. Because when the story started, it was so good, and then now it's such a sad ending. When you think about it, one, there is a famine in somewhere called Bethlehem. When you look up the word Bethlehem, you realize it means house of bread. And so it's very ironic that there's a famine, house of bread. And then Naomi has 1 husband and 2 sons. And so there's a sense of security and provision that Naomi is assured. That in societies where women did not engage in economic activity, you had to... The only way you are sure you have a roof over your head, food on your table, the only way you are sure is if you have male family members. And that's taken away from Naomi. And then I bet he used to live in a loving community. Labda alikuwa anajua anko anaishi kule, kazi na kuhuku, neighbors wake wanaumbananga sukari. But say there's no that option. You're in a foreign land. These people are not your people. And so the painting of the beginning of the story is very dull, it's very dark, it gets sad and melancholic very fast. But the ending of the story is a beautiful one, and I'll read it in a minute. But if you notice it, even when Ruth decides to stick to Naomi and says, you know what, you're going back to your people, I'll come back with you. We are told at the beginning of the first chapter that when they went back, it was the beginning of the barley harvest. And so we don't know how many years have passed, but we are knowing, okay, it's not what it was. There was a famine. When they're coming back, guys are even harvesting, meaning kulinyesha, waka plant, nini, it's harvest time. So it's like contrasting. And so now it's a good time in Bethlehem. They're actually harvesting. There's food. There's barley, house of bread. And then it goes on, this, when the story is ending, we're being told that Ruth gets a son, and somehow this is Naomi's son, because there was a guy called Boaz who was a kinsman redeemer, which means now Naomi has a son who's going to be able to provide for him. So Naomi is getting it together. He has now Boaz. He discovered there's a guy called Boaz. They've actually been getting something to eat because Ruth was gleaning from his farm. And then now they even have a son. And so that's exciting. And then even the shida of her being a foreigner and alone, right now it gets so dramatic. And there's a whole family around Naomi. And they come and they say, yo, you've gotten a son. I'll actually read it. It says, so Boaz took Ruth into his home, and she became his wife. When he slept with her, the Lord enabled her to become pregnant, and she gave birth to a son. Then the women of the town said to Naomi, Praise the Lord who has now provided a redeemer for your family. May this child be famous in Israel. May he restore your youth and care for you in your old age, for he is a son of your daughter-in-law who loves you and has been better to you than seven sons. Not six, not eight, seven. Anyway, he's been better to you than seven sons. So, and then it goes on to say, Naomi took the baby and cuddled him to her breast, and she cared for him as if he were her own. And the neighbor women said, now at last Naomi has a son again. And they named him Obed. He became the father of Jesse and the grandfather of David. Such a lovely ending to the story. That ultimately even this kiddo that they got was a father of Jesse and ended up being the grandfather of David. So he's the grandfather of David. And that's a perfect story. I want to tell you why that's good news as well. When you read the beginning of the story, if you notice, this is what it said. It says, in the time when the judges ruled, there lived a man called Elimelech, and he had a wife who was called Naomi, and they had two sons. In the times when judges ruled. When you think that, you should be like, it's that time. It's also a sad thing, because when the judges ruled, that's the time when Israel really went on a downward spiral, and they sunk and they sunk and they sunk, and they had leaders here and there who were good for battle, but that's all they were good for. They never really brought Israel to loving loyalty of the God that has saved them from Egypt. And so when you read the story, it's the same story. It's about, again, Israel. The Israelites were wicked and did evil before the Lord. And so the Lord allowed enemies to plunder them. And then they cried out, God, suit us idea. And then a leader is raised up, Deborah, Gideon, and so on and so forth. And they fight off these enemies. But they never really deal with the problem. The problem wasn't the enemies. The problem was the wickedness and the evil that they did. And the enemies were just a way of God disciplining them. But these leaders never dealt with the root of the matter. They just killed off the enemies. And then they're happy. They're back again at a peaceful life. And then they go back into the wickedness. And there are a number of cycles where you read again and again. And the Israelites did evil, and the Israelites did evil. And so there's so much chaos and confusion because of what has happened. And so when you just think of that setting, when you read in the times when the judges ruled, you should also be like face palm and say like, that's not a good time. You know, the same way if you say in the year 2020, someone random we'll actually think you're just naming a year, such as 1994, 1985, 1632, and so on and so forth. But I think for us, we know what 2020 was. And so when someone says, in the year 2020, you're really like, it's that year. Where's this story going? And that's the point. And so even the ending of the book of Judges, a number of times it keeps on saying, in those days, Israel had no king. In those days, Israel had no king. And that's why it ending by saying, and he was a father of Jesse and the grandfather of David. That's very significant, because it's saying that the problem for the judges is that there was no king, and now he is the greatest king that ever was. And so it's a story of hope, that it ends with so much hope. This actually is a kid that brought David into the world, so to speak. And so they're thinking, how do we labor this point again? That for the first problem statement, which was in the times when the judges ruled, how are we going to show that this has been dealt with? And they go on, like it would have been perfect in English, Ishia Apokwa, the grandfather of David, but they decided they put another genealogy. And guess how many people are there? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. And the 10th person is David. wonder if this David guy is going to play a significant role in the story that's about to come for the nation of Israel. I wonder. Let's breathe. Seen that numbered genealogies tell a story, or rather the author may use a specific number within a genealogy to make a specific point. So let's look at the specific one that we have right now, which is the one that's running from Abraham to Jesus, and the author makes it clear, just in case you missed it, here's what I did, 14, 14, 14. When you think about it, 14, 14, 14, that's total 42, that's 7 times 2 times 3, that's 7 times 6. You're there with me? So it means there's this first 7th, this is second 7th, third 7th, fourth 7th. Najishuku sai, because I have people who laugh at me because of how I do the TH sound. I hadn't noticed it, but I'll continue from where I am. 5th, 7th, 6th, 7th. It's so bad. But when you're thinking about it, this story is about Jesus. So ideally, Jesus will be starting the 7th, 7th. Ooh, I like where this is going. That's what you should be thinking ideally. You think 6th, 7th, Sime Peter. Now we are getting into the 7th, 7th. So when we began thinking about the number 7, I took you back to the creation story, where it says that God created the world in 6 days, and then on the 7th day, he rested. Something significant that probably you should notice is, at the end of every day, there's this phrase, and it says it was evening and it was morning, and that was the first day. On the second day, it was evening and it was morning, and that was the second day. On the third day, it was evening and it was morning, and that was the third day. And that happens for every single day. However, for the seventh day, it doesn't have that. It just says on the seventh day, God rested. He ceased from the work that he was doing. He had finished creating. And so he called that day holy. It ended, nini, nini, and we go into the next story. Like there's no evening and morning. And you should wonder, aye? So we don't... What that means, for sure, is that this seventh day had no end. This is ingine for sure. Ali created demarcations, tukajua imeishia hapa. It was evening, it was morning. That was the second day, and you're sure the next statement is starting with on the third day. But for this seventh day, it had no end. Okay? Hold that thought. So here's why I'm taking us back to the creation story that's in Genesis. I think Matthew, in writing his story and beginning his story, I see him borrowing from what the author of Genesis and what the author of Genesis did in beginning his story as well. And so when you think about it, Matthew wants to tell a story about Jesus. What he does is there's a first bit that's the genealogy that we are covering right now. And then now there's a narrative that where he says, and this is how Jesus was born. So there was a guy called Joseph, Mary, nini, 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 and Jesus is born. Okay. So there are two stories that are happening. Also, when you think about it, in the book of Genesis, when the author is trying to tell a story about the origin of humanity, he does it also in two stories. He talks about the first one, about the days that we are familiar with, and then about the second one, where his man is breathed into, he is formed, breathed into, placed in a garden, there are fruits, oh, he split, So two significant stories. And you can, it may not jump at you immediately, but you can tell he is employing the same writing technique. So the first one is very poetic in terms of your idea repetition. I don't know if you can see it, where it says, on the third day, and God said, let there be, and it was good, evening and morning, third day. Fourth day, and God said, let there be, it was evening and it was morning, God said it was good, fourth day. Like there's a rhythm and pattern to it. And that's the same thing that Matthew employs when he begins the story. He says, Abraham begot Isaac, Isaac begot Jacob, Jacob begot Judah, Judah. You'd hardly think of it as poetry yourself, but it's that idea of like repetition, but we are going somewhere. I'm getting you somewhere. And then also the second bit is that the first story is very broad in its scope. And so like the creation story, we're being told about everything, about the planets that are uko, about the sky, about the grass, about the fish that we didn't know that was there inside the water. We're being told about everything in the first creation story. But the second creation story narrows down, and it's only things that are affecting the human that we are being told about. And so we are being told about a garden, we are being told about how he doesn't have a partner, and so on and so forth. And also in the Matthew narrative, same thing. The first one is very broad. Let's start from Abraham. Let's name all these people who people don't probably even know their stories about. But then the second story, it narrows down, and it's very specific. There are these two jamaas. And they loved each other, but it was almost a scandal, but an angel intervened to communicate, and that's how Jesus was born. And so I see Matthew employing the writing structure of Genesis 1 and 2 into his beginning of his narrative, and that's why I think he's also trying to say something through the genealogy. And so we say Jesus is beginning the seventh. And we saw in the creation story that the seventh day had no end. So here's what Matthew is trying to say through the genealogy. Okay, maybe one of the things, considering I've said we'll do other videos about that specific bit, that's the genealogy. Here's what he's trying to say, that it's the beginning of the end, and that Jesus is here to establish a family that has no end. And so when you think about where he traces the story, he starts from Abraham. If you know the story before the story of Abraham, it's the story of the Tower of Babel, where humanity throw their fists in the air and they say, we don't want you. You're building a tower to the heavens. And God comes down and sees what they're doing, and he just scatters them all over the earth. You don't want to be with me? Cool. And then the next story starts, and it's about Abraham. And he says, I will bless you. I will make your name great, and from you all the families of the earth are going to be blessed. And so it's a promise about how, though people rejected him, and God was like, Nivo mnataka, sawa, but he took in Abraham, and he was going to start the story again with Abraham, and through Abraham, all the families of the earth are going to be blessed. People will be able to join the family of God when they decide to align themselves with Abraham. That's a storyline. And so even when you think about Paul and how he thinks about believers, one of the phrases that he always uses is that you are Abraham's seed, meaning you're not his biological seed per se, but you are in the family of Abraham and thus in the family of God. That though people walikuwa wamedecide tujisikie na wewe, God really was intent on starting a human family, and he did so with Abraham. And for those who aligned themselves with him and decided to be a part of his family, they become the family of God. And so when you read a story that's beginning with Abraham and it's being traced down, we are trying to see the idea of how do we get into the family of God. And so that's what Matthew is trying to say through the genealogy. It's the beginning of the end, and Jesus is here to establish a family that has no end. Remember, the seventh day, there's no evening, no morning. And so this seventh, that's starting by Jesus, also ideally wouldn't have an end to this family. So all that being said, I think this is the best way to respond to this thought that is coming out of this passage. Number one is for the unbeliever, for the person who's new to Christianity, for the person who's skeptical and would want to just read for the sake. So one, if you've watched all through, yo, kudos. It's been a long one. But the point is that Matthew is inviting you into a story about someone who he thinks is very significant. And that's a point he was making through the genealogy, that this guy right here is significant. And he continues telling the story of Jesus throughout the entire book. I dare you, I invite you into the book that you may dive in and see what's this fuss about Jesus. What is he all about? Why did Matthew want to make this point? He's definitely drawing attention to this character. What is he all about? And when you think even about the concept of the family, I'll give you one spoiler. When you read through, probably one thing you're thinking is, hey, there was a lot of begetting. I wonder who Jesus will beget. There's no one. You'll read through, you won't see any romantic interest. You won't see Jesus having a girlfriend or getting married and having kids. And so you're wondering, there was a theme about family. Where has that gone to? But Jesus is establishing a new type of family, and he does it differently. And I'll quote from the same Matthew in chapter 12, verse 46 to 50. And this is what it says. As Jesus was speaking to the crowd, his mothers and brothers stood outside asking to speak to him. Someone told Jesus, Jesus, your mother and your brothers, wakwapa inje, they want to speak to you. Jesus asked, who is my mother? Who is my brothers? Who are my brothers? Then he pointed to his disciples and he said, yo, look, those are my mother and brothers. Anyone who does the will of my Father in heaven is my brother and my sister and my mother. And Jesus is saying that the way we get to be in the family of God is by responding to the will of the Father, being obedient to Jesus and his teachings, following through with what he's all about, loving him and trying to discover in my own life, what am I supposed to do? What has God placed in my heart? But that begins by knowing Jesus, loving Jesus, being obsessed with Jesus, I would say, and then responding to his teachings and what he's instructing us. And so for the unbeliever, I invite you to join the family of God. And this happens by believing in Jesus Christ. And our belief is shown by how we respond to Jesus' teachings. That we see he says a thing and we believe him for who he is and we follow through with it. That's how we join the family. For the believer, here is how we respond. First and foremost, we definitely thank God that we are a part of his family. That we have this grand privilege to be called the children of God. And that's amazing. But more so, as part of continuing to do the will of the Father, there's a mandate that Jesus gave to us in Matthew 28, that we may be able to multiply this family and let other people in. And it's in the last bit of the book. So we were talking about the first bit of the book, in the last bit of the book, where he says, therefore go and make disciples of all nations. You remember what he said? He pointed to the disciples and he said, you see those disciples? They're my family. And he says, go and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit. Teach these new disciples to obey all the commands I have given you. You remember what he said? You know who are my mothers and brothers? Those who do the will of the Father. So teach these new disciples to obey all the commands I have given you. And be sure of this, I will be with you even to the end of the age. And for the believer, that's what we are meant to do. We are meant to tell people of this grand story that God is establishing a family, and the way that we are able to get in is by believing in the Son that He sent, and through Him we get to move away from just being like His creation, so to speak, and so on and so forth, and we become His children, and we become a part of the family of God. And that's my invitation to you, that would you be a part of this family? Would you be a part of this family that has no end? Remember the seventh. We all come from families. We know how messy they can get. We know how complicated they can get. But think about a family that is genuine care, that is genuine love, that is genuine trust, that there is legit provision and protection from a father who loves, and so on and so forth. And this is a family that you're being invited to. If our human families, sometimes they fall apart, they break, how much more do you think perfect and blissful will the family of God be? And that's the invitation to you. Would you be a part of the family of God? That's it for today. Ndoa Teachings. Adibadai.